I love a good story. I love the way a well-told story has the power to make you think, laugh, cry, and experience all the emotions in between. There are so many different ways to experience a story. You can have it told to you, watch it on TV or in a movie, or read it. I can remember the first time I discovered the power of a good story. I was about 7 and had been given The Velveteen Rabbit as a gift. Same book, binding, everything. I was lying on the couch at my grandmother's house, and I got to the part about the rabbit being thrown on the rubbish heap, and I started to cry. And I cried through the whole ending of the book, and as the rabbits transformed into a real rabbit, and when I was done reading, the sad feelings lingered, and I was just amazed by the discovery that my entire mood could be altered by something I had read. I read that book many times as a child, and it's still one of my favorites. There's something special about a well-loved story that you have heard, seen, or read multiple times. You get to know the characters, you know what is going to happen, but you still feel the roller coaster of emotions, as well as the anticipation of how the story ends and conflict is resolved. But sometimes, no matter how much you love a story, you can also start to feel like you've read it so many times there's nothing more in it for you. How many moms here have hidden Goodnight Moon from their kids because you cannot stand to read Goodnight Nobody, Goodnight Mush one more time? I know I have a tendency to tune out if I'm very familiar with a story. I may not read it as closely, relying on what I think I know about the characters and my previous perceptions. It was with this kind of attitude that I approached our study of Ruth this summer. I had read it, heard it told, or taught countless times. I wondered what I could possibly learn that could be fresh and different. I started my study of Ruth with a book by Carolyn Custis James, The Gospel of Ruth. I highly recommend it to anyone who is looking to dig a little deeper into the story, and it gave me a whole new excitement for Ruth and her story, and so I will be sharing some of her thoughts and ideas today with you. As I continued to read commentaries soaked in lectures each Wednesday, as well as sat with the women in my small group, it became quite clear there is still so much that the Lord can teach me through this small book in His Word. Ruth had always seemed to me like a sweet love story tucked into the pages of the Old Testament, a little breather between the terrible times of the judges and before the historical accounts of the kings of Israel. But it is about so much more than a love story between Ruth and Boaz. It is about loss and despair, obedience and perseverance, hope and redemption, God's faithful provision for His believers, death and life, and about everything that happens in between. The book is named Ruth, but it is Naomi's story that we start and end with. The last scene centers on Naomi cradling little Obed on her lap. What thoughts must Naomi have been pondering as she held this miracle baby, whom she, in her darkest days as Mara the Bitter, never dreamed would be part of her life story? Why does the Lord end the book with this picture of Naomi and a listing of the genealogy of the house of David, the great Israelite king? How do we, with our own life stories, fit in this picture? Even though we haven't shared Naomi and Ruth's particular experiences, we can certainly identify with the struggles they went through. Speaking of their struggles, I think we need to acknowledge something here about Naomi and her suffering and loss. Yes, her life had been renewed by the birth of Obed. Yes, Elimelech's name is brought back from the dead. Yes, her emptiness has now been filled. But this does not negate the loss that she experienced. I am sure that until the day she died, Naomi mourned the loss of her husband and her two boys. The very real losses and griefs that we bear in this world will not be erased just because we experience a turn of fortune or prosperity. Many of you have experienced great losses, but you do not stop hurting just because you can enjoy good things again. The score isn't evened out, and it never will be this side of heaven. Our losses are real, deep, and painful. But the end of the story is that God eventually brings an even greater joy of the resurrection. And that joy is somehow sweeter because we had first lost what is precious to us. One day we will be whole and new. One day we will see Jesus and He'll wipe away every tear. And that is why we can live with hope, even in the midst of the brokenness of this world. And that is where the story started. A broken family and a broken woman. We walked with Naomi on that dry and dusty road back to Bethlehem, our hearts heavy with her loss. We felt the weight of her suffering. We were astonished, along with Naomi, at the happy discovery that Ruth had gleaned in Boaz's field and that he was a close relative. We felt anticipation when Ruth went to the threshing floor and then came back and told Naomi that Boaz would take care of them one way or another. We felt satisfaction in the way Boaz dealt with Mr. So-and-so at the city gates and when he announced his intentions to fulfill the obligations as Elimelech's kinsman redeemer. And now we come to the last part of the story. This last section of Ruth has been seen as the fairy tale ending to a romantic story, and it truly is a wonderful picture. There is a wedding to a noble man, a baby, and a closing scene with the grandmother holding her newborn grandson as the village women bless her. You can almost see the Disney choreographed dance and catchy song of joy swelling as the scene closes. But to reduce this story to a love story with a perfect happy ending is to trivialize this book and its message. We need to remember that the true hero of this book is God, and how, as Custis James puts it, he used two unlikely women to carry his redemptive purposes forward into the future. So, with that in mind, let's revisit these closing scenes. The last we see of Naomi, she is seated, and her grandson is in her lap. The women of the village surround her. The same women who heard her cry of bitterness now shower her with blessings, acknowledging God's provision for her. They say that Ruth is better than seven sons. As Custis James says, Naomi is actually better off with Ruth than a lot of women who gave birth to what the ancient world regarded as the perfect number of sons. Older women counted on their sons to care for them, to protect them from exploitation and the harsh elements of society, to be their voice, to stand up for their rights, and to preserve their father's name and estate by bringing the next generation of male descendants into the world. Ruth did all of these things for Naomi, at great cost to herself, and in a culture that tied her hands behind her back, denied her a voice, refused access to the legal system, regarded her as useless. It was all uphill for Ruth, but she did it anyway. Not even seven sons would have done as much. Ruth showed faithfulness to Naomi in her obedience and perseverance, even in the face of overwhelming circumstances. Ruth promised Naomi that she would follow her and her God, even to the death. Naomi's God, the God of Israel, rewarded Ruth's faithfulness by providing for the women through Boaz. God's provision throughout the book of Ruth stands as a testament of his faithfulness to his people. When Boaz took on the role of kinsman redeemer, he announced to the townspeople that on that day they were witnesses to his actions, and they, in effect, had witnessed the goodness and faithfulness of God to Ruth and the entire family of Elimelech. The townspeople celebrated by blessing both Ruth and Boaz. They started with Ruth, linking their blessing for her with Rachel and Leah, the mothers of the 12 tribes of Israel. In remembering these two women, they asked God to give Ruth fertility that is comparable to these ancient mothers. They connected her to the line of Israel and the continued building of the house of Israel. They follow this blessing with one for Boaz, that he would have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. As a happy result of Ruth's fertility, they wish him standing or prosperity through his larger family, and that his reputation would gain renown or become famous because of this family. The last part of their blessing actually concerns Perez and his mother Tamar. Perez was the ancestor of the preeminent Judean Perizzite clan, which produced prominent leaders. His mother Tamar had circumstances that bear a striking resemblance to Ruth's. Both had lost their husbands and were childless. Both were outsiders to God's covenant. In both cases, the nearest relative of their husband's family refused to follow Levirate law and marry them and provide for them. Both were daring in their plans to rescue their husband's lines, although Tamar's story was certainly notorious in Israelite history. This is how commentator Robert Hubbard summarizes Tamar's story. Perez was the oldest of twin boys born to Judah under somewhat scandalous circumstances. Tamar had been married to Judah's son. Since Judah refused to give Tamar his youngest son as a husband after Ur's death, she posed as a prostitute and became pregnant by an unsuspecting customer, Judah himself, and gave birth to Perez and Zerah. The words whom Tamar bore to Judah recall that famous episode in tribal lore. Its mention probably led the ancient audience to compare that story with the present story. In short, the crowd wished that Boaz found a family line of similar prominence in Judah. This blessing seems extremely grand and far-reaching as we consider Ruth, the humble Moabitess. That she would produce descendants who are of such distinction must have seemed hopeful at best. Yet, God takes these hopes for their future and answers them beyond what anyone could have imagined on that early summer day thousands of years ago. When we move to the genealogy at the end of the chapter, we see that Ruth's story surpasses that of Tamar's, and Boaz's descendants are even greater than those of Perez. Their child Obed is the grandfather of King David, Israel's greatest king. With the perspective of time, we can see that the Lord's care for the two defenseless widows was part of his plan that would benefit all of Israel. We can see the continuation of this blessing in the genealogy of Matthew 1. As glorious as David's empire was, God had an even grander purpose that would include the whole world as a recipient of his grace and care. In Matthew, David's royal line is carried down to Jesus. Also included in Jesus' genealogy is Ruth, one of only a handful of women to be named or mentioned. Excluding Mary, the mother of Jesus, it is even more interesting to note that the women included are not even Jewish. Two are Canaanite, one is a Moabite, and one a Hittite. Each of these women were featured prominently in Old Testament history. There is Tamar, whose scandalous story we have just reviewed. Boaz himself came from the line of Rahab, who actually was a prostitute, but she showed kindness to the Israelite spies and was included in the covenant community, and thus is mentioned here in the genealogy. Third, there is Ruth, a real-life example of a Proverbs 31 woman, but for all of her worthiness, she is still a foreigner. Finally, there is Bathsheba, who is not even mentioned by name, but is listed as Uriah's wife, and she was in an adulterous relationship with King David. It is remarkable that out of all the women whom Jesus was descended from, these four are highlighted. Two things are clear. First, that Jesus came for Jews and Gentiles alike. Gentiles have always been a part of the Lord's plan for the redemptive history of the world. They have always been a part of the story. Secondly, it is clear these women were not perfect. Jesus came to rescue sinners, sinners like his own ancestors, sinners like us. In spite of who you are or what you have done, Jesus came for you. God's grace was extended to Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba, and is extended to you and to me. What is your story? How is God using you in the redemptive history of the world? Do you think your story is not that significant? I am tempted to think that way when I look at my own. I have a husband and three kids. Each day is a variation on the standard list of responsibilities that include making meals, shopping, cleaning, and laundry. I parent my children, support and love my husband, and engage in the lives of my friends and larger family. In the midst of this, I've experienced both great loss as well as great joy. But as I look to the day-to-day, I do not see it as all that grand or glorious. And I'm sure that Ruth didn't see her life that way either. As John Piper says in his sermon on Ruth, the book of Ruth teaches us that God's purpose for our life is to connect us to something far greater than ourselves. God wants us to know that when we follow him, our lives always mean more than we think they do. For the Christian, there's always a connection between the ordinary events of life and the stupendous work of history. Everything we do in obedience to God, no matter how small, is significant. The deep satisfaction of the Christian life is that it is not given over to trifles. Serving a widowed mother-in-law, gleaning in a field, falling in love, having a baby. For the Christian, these things are all connected to eternity. They are part of something so much bigger than they seem. How can God use your daily obedience to connect you to something so much greater than the sum of its parts? Doing laundry, grocery shopping, making your family meals, playing with your children, interacting with coworkers, friends, and family. These things make up the chapters and verses of our own lives, our own stories. God calls us to be faithful, and he will continue to be faithful to us as we live out our stories for him. At its heart, Ruth is a story about God and his faithfulness to the living and the dead. It is also about his working through faithful people, people who displayed his character and acted out of love. We, too, are called to be a part of this greater story. We are part of God's plan to carry out his gracious purposes, which include using his people who reflect and express his faithful character, and that of his son to bless others.